You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Chris Hillman. Chris Hillman was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a founding member of one of the most important and influential bands of the 1960s, The Byrds. Before helping to found The Byrds, Chris Hillman was a respected bluegrass musician. When he left The Byrds, Chris Hillman started the Flying Burrito Brothers. He joined forces with Stephen Stills to form the band Manassas. He was part of the supergroup Souther, Hillman, and Furay, and he enjoyed enormous success on the country charts with the Desert Rose Band. Now Chris Hillman shares his life story in a great book called Time Between, My Life as a Byrd, Burrito Brother, and Beyond. Chris Hillman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, so much.
It's really an honor to meet you, and thanks so much for being here. And thanks for writing such a great book. You know, I really love the early chapters with your youth in a very surprisingly rural Southern California with your horse and all that.
Well, back then it was very rural, Gary, and it was a great little town. It was just starting to be a retirement place where very wealthy people would retire. And now it's become a very wealthy enclave. If I had more time, I could tell you the story of how I, at 19, 20 years old in The Byrds, I go back to visit Rancho Santa Fe. And a friend of mine's mother was a real estate broker. And this is 1965. She says, let's buy a couple of lots here.
Uh-huh.
You get the money. I said, yeah, I think so. And it was like $10,000. Which was a fortune for me then. And I passed on it. She said, you know, I love you dearly, but you're going to regret this the rest of your life. A lot, Gary, in Rancho Santa Fe goes for $1.5 million to $2 million now. Not an acre, a lot.
Wow.
Those are those, if only I'd have, anyway, so. And it was a great.
Who can see into the future? But, you know, I grew up in Southern California, and AM radio at that time was kind of genre free. They played country music and rock music and soul music, a lot of variety. And, yeah. And I was wondering, what were the first records that you remember being important to you?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was my age, my generation, so to speak. I was totally taken with the early rock and roll. 1956. Elvis, I think I first heard in 55, but then Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, all of them. Fantastic. Eddie Cochran. And I would buy singles and 59, 69 cents. I'd buy singles and loved it. I didn't want to learn the guitar then. I was just captivated by the music. It was such an exciting, rebellious thing. And we had music in our house all the time, not by anybody playing it so much as my folks listened to big band stuff. They had great taste, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Peggy Lee, Ella Fitzgerald, something like that. And so I just loved the rock and roll when it came out. Yeah. And then it sort of went to sleep for a while in 57, 58, 9. And that's when I got into folk music. And then from there to bluegrass and country. Yeah.
Well, so I know you were really into bluegrass and country, obviously, but were you also listening at that time to like the New York folk singers of Tom Paxton or Phil Oakes or Bob Dylan or any of that?
Well, I love Dylan. I loved early Dylan stuff. I didn't listen to Tom Paxton that much. I certainly was aware of him. But I was listening to Woody Guthrie, the stuff my sister had turned me on to, my older sister. Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, the Weavers, and loved Leadbelly to this day. I still think Leadbelly was one of the great geniuses. The way he played 12-string guitar was fantastic. So, and then I go from there and listening to bluegrass, that did it for me.
That was the hook.
Yep.
You know, in your career, you've worked with some truly creative and yet undeniably insufferable people, like Well, David Crosby and Graham Parsons. And yet in your book, Time Between, you don't have anything bad to say about anybody. How is it that you're such a forgiving person?
Well, I just don't think it's relevant to keep hammering away at something that happened to you with a suspect individual in your life, something that might have gone down 30 years ago or something. I rather look at what they accomplished, what they could have accomplished, and what they did accomplish. And both of them, Graham Parsons and Graham and David Crosby, and David certainly accomplished a lot. We're talented. David, fantastic. Graham could have done more. He just, you know, we lost him early, and I couldn't work with him at a certain point. And as it says in the book, I had to fire him. And he's a wonderful guy. We wrote some great songs together that were, many people have recorded, and the ultimate stamp of approval is when somebody emulates, takes, does your work, covers a song you wrote, or this or that, or, you know, plagiarizes something, but it's the ultimate stamp of approval. So yeah, there were some interesting people. Sometimes I feel, and I have been asked whether I was the peacekeeper in these bands. Somebody said to me, you were like Graham Nash. You were sort of keeping the maniacs at bay, keeping them calm, able to perform. And all. I said, maybe so. Yeah, maybe we do share that, Graham Nash and I, yeah.
Well, I saw, you know, it's interesting because you've given thousands of performances and concerts over the years, and I've had the luck of seeing you three times. And even though you've given hundreds of performances, the three that I saw, you talk about all three of them in your book. And that was probably because I was there.
That's exactly right. How'd you know?
But one of them was I saw you with Souther, Hillman, and Furay at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get you to hope I'm going to hold this up to Zoom so you can sign my
song. Oh, yeah.
it looked to me like you guys were not getting along on stage. I mean, I remember that I saw J.D. Souther singing Pretty Goodbyes, I think it was, and he was kind of like very, you know, kind of lethargically standing at the microphone. And it looked like you and Richie Furay were maybe having an argument behind.
it was, as I've said, I think there's a photo in the book, and we're the three of us, it's a picture of us in an office. I think it was at a desk at the recording studio, and we have the sourest looks on our face. I said, and I wrote the caption, well, it looked good on paper.
Yeah,
something like that. But it was a great idea on paper, but really was three songwriters. We never got together as a band. We didn't develop as a band. And Richie and I had a lot more experience working in groups than JD. JD really hadn't done that. And I love them both. They're great guys. And once again, but it wasn't my favorite band. And I really don't do any of that material. Actually, I do. I did find one off the first album, the one you have, that I started doing. Yeah, again. But I remember that Santa Monica Civic. Yeah, and I was reacquainted with my wife there. Connie came to see me play. We had dated in 1968, and then I see her at the Civic, which is what, 74 or 75?
74, yeah.
Yeah. And there's Connie. So it was meant to be for me to play that show, be it good or bad on stage. We got together with my wife 41 years, no, we got married in 79. So a long time ago.
Yeah.
years ago. Yeah.
So that was a very significant night then.
Oh, it was a great night. Yeah.
And for me too, I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed you guys.
A lot of people, Gary, loved Souther, Hillman, Furay. It wasn't the most exciting band I was ever in. I mean, it had the potential once again. It just didn't work out. So,
well, you know, since you're, you know, a pioneer in the music of, you know, country rock or whatever they want to call it. Did you feel, you know, when the Eagles like hit it so big and were selling gazillions of records, did it make you jealous? Were you?
No. They did it right. And I think Glenn Frey and Glenn and Don Henley, they came and they'd watch the Burritos at, we'd play the Troubadour, the club in West Hollywood. It had Hootenanny Night and this and that. But Glenn was really interested, and he was sort of studying us, and they did it right. The Eagles really, really, they had the songs, and the execution was great. The Burritos had the songs, Gary, but our execution was very sloppy back then. I don't know why, because here I am coming off of the Byrds playing 8 miles high, and So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, which is smoking tracks. And the Beatles, like I said, we had great songs, and obviously we were they were covered by so many other artists, the songs Graham and I wrote on that album. And but it just wasn't, yeah. And then the Eagles, no, I wasn't jealous. I felt they deserved it. They did their homework. How about that? They did their homework, and they did it right. Yeah.
Yeah. When you, I also saw you with Manassas at Winterland, which was a great show. Mm-hmm. And you did a solo set, or you, I think it was you and Al Perkins, the little
Correct.
Set in the middle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was just wonderful. What, you want to talk a little bit about Manassas and how you became involved with them?
Loved it. Loved that band. Once again, I always had a situation when one door would start to close and another one would open, which is what happened at the end of Manassas. But I'll go into Manassas first. So of course, after doing a session for Stephen in Miami, and then he gives me this beautiful instrument, mandolin, just fantastic. It's right here in my house under lock and key.
Yeah.
And then he said, what do you think about doing a group? I said, really? Let me think about it. It took me 2 seconds, excuse me. And I said, absolutely. Well, the guys he was playing with were really good musicians. I mean, I didn't know them. I knew Joe Lala, who was the percussionist, but I didn't know Al Perkins. Well, here's what he asked. He wanted Al and I to start be in this band that he was going to start. And we both thought it was a great idea. One was, here I'm just telling you about the Flying Burrito Brothers were just a little, you know, sketchy on their performance. And then Manassas is like 10 steps up the ladder. And it was really something I had to be on my toes. And it was good. I like to have to reach for something, you know. And working with Stills back then, he was at the top of his game. He was singing great. He was writing good. And I learned a lot from him. I watched him. I listened. We wrote some good songs together. And it was a joy. And Manassas had a great run for 2 years. He gets pressured to go back with CSN. The door starts to shut, Gary, and another one opens. It's Souther, Hill, and Furay. And it was David Geffen, who was the manager of CSN at the time, and then decided, I'm going to make another super group just in case these guys go crazy again. Souther, Hill, and Furay didn't quite work out, but it was a wonderful idea, like I say, yeah.
It Doesn't Matter is one of my favorite songs of yours.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to this record, which I love. It's an album that you did.
At
Edwards Barn. You did this wonderful version of 8 Miles High. And I was wondering if you could sort of take us back to the origin of that song, of 8 Miles High. That was a key moment.
I think it was came into being on a tour we were doing in the fall of 65. Dick Clark, Caravan of Stars, right? And this is fantastic. Now, this is tours Dick Clark would do. And it was almost like late 50s, like the Buddy Holly Big Bopper package. That's where we would go out and play high school. So it was Bo Diddley, the Byrds, Paul Revere and the Raiders, We Five, yes. And playing in the Midwest. And we had some credence with having a hit with Tambourine Man. So we got our own vehicle. They were in a big bus. We were in our own mobile home. But that's where 8 Miles High, we start listening to John Coltrane and Ravi Shankar. Roger McGuinn rigged up a little record player through a speaker. And we were listening to all this eclectic stuff, you know. And that's where 8 Miles High came from. And it really was after the summer of 65 when we had gone to London on a tour. And Gene Clark really came up with that idea of the lyric 8 Miles High. It's really, we were trying to talk about an airplane's altitude, but it's really 7 miles high if you're doing the math and what a plane can fly. I think Roger said, let's do 8 miles. It sounds better in the song. We took a few liberties. And the lyrics are fantastic. And it we're describing, here it is, August in London. It's raining and damp and dark. We don't know where we are. We've never been out of the country. And it was good. That's where the song came about. But the initial inspiration was listening to John Coltrane. That's where I really got my bass line to kick that song off.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. And we're talking this week with Chris Hillman, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame founding member of the band The Byrds, the Flying Burrito Brothers, Manassas with Stephen Stills, and the Desert Rose Band. Chris Hillman, in your new book, Time Between, My Life as a Bird, Burrito Brother and Beyond, you mention the famous Los Angeles session musicians known as the Wrecking Crew. They played on tons of hit records in the 1960s, from records by Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra to the Mamas and the Papas and the Monkees, and they also played on some of the Byrds records.
Gary, the Wrecking Crew played on the Mr. Tambourine Man and the B-side, I Knew I'd Want You, two songs. And why did they do that? Because Columbia just signed us to a singles deal. I think they were hedging their bets. That's fine. It's a very slick record. Personally, I think we could have probably covered it, but it's okay. It achieved what we wanted. It got us in the door big time, big single all over Europe and America. And then that was it. We did everything else. I've had people say, oh, you didn't play on your own records. I said, listen to the first album. That's us, obviously. It's not the Wrecking Crew. Yeah. In all its glory.
and did you feel prepared, you know, when Mr. Tambourine Man became such a big hit and then suddenly you were playing live? Were you confident playing live in those early days?
I think the other, Roger and David and maybe Gene had a little more, they had a little more confidence, obviously. I was very shy, but I think maybe a little more experience. I was just coming out of local bluegrass hillbilly bars and bluegrass music. It wasn't exactly the show, being a showman on stage. It was like serious, you know, you're up there with that mandolin, put it up, and you know, it's a lot to think about. You're playing fast, you're singing three-part harmonies. I watched the first time, I realized, oh my gosh, so we're doing rock and roll in a sense. We're in a rock band. And I had to really think about it. And I finally got over my shyness. And when Gene took off and he decided he wanted to go solo, I was put on the front line to sing and all that, you know. So I learned. I had good teachers too.
Well, what a great, the Notorious Bird Brothers, one of my favorite records of all time. I mean, this record has been.
And you know, Roger McGuinn and I ended up doing that whole album and with Gary Usher, who was the producer at Columbia, wonderful, wonderful producer. We had such a good time with that record. Yeah.
And were you riding horses again? Because there's a horse.
I was, as a matter of fact, that period of time. And I'm not sure why I had the shirt off. I'm not sure where I was going with that. But but I had horses again in Topanga Canyon. And you know Topanga Canyon. So here I was, again, had bought a horse, a couple of horses I had. And Mike was riding, Mike Clark. And we just decided, let's go ride off. And we found this cabin back in Topanga Canyon area.
I love that picture.
Thanks. Yeah. And of course, the horse represents somebody who used to be in the band. But anyway.
Well, the other time that I saw you live was in 2018 with Marty Stewart and Roger McGuinn doing your Sweetheart of the Rodeo show at
Ace
Hotel. Yeah. Which was, gosh, what a great night that was.
Tell me, I loved it. I'm saying that because I absolutely loved that tour. I loved working with Marty. And of course, Roger and I hadn't played together for 20, 25 years. And it was like no time had passed. Marty is a wonderful man. The Superlatives are probably one of the finest bands I've ever played. And I mean it. They are so good. But the best part of that whole tour was the attitude. Everybody was so professional. And we just started, all of a sudden, we were doing sellout business. From the first night at the Ace, then we had another night. And then off we went. And so much fun. I really must say, it might have been the best, if not one of the best tours I'd ever gone on. Yeah.
Well, were the shows recorded? Will we hear them?
Yes, they were recorded every night. And I actually mentioned that to Marty a week ago. Maybe we should take a look and have one of your guys look at the tapes. And maybe down the road, we'll put out a live recording.
I really think you should. And of course, the music. I mean, you didn't just play Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which is such a great.
Yeah. But
you played all kinds of stuff earlier.
Well, I would sit there, Gary, every night when after the break and Marty and the band would come out and they would do. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was right toward the end of the show. They did Running Down a Dream, Tom Petty's song, and they did it acoustically. And Marty's playing the mandolin. It was fantastic. And by the way, he is one of the best mandolin players I've ever heard in my life. I mean, he's seriously good. I would watch them. I just go on the side of the stage. I'd sit down in a chair every night, and I'd look at those guys. They were so good. Yeah.
Well, the fact that you mentioned Tom Petty and this fantastic record, Biding My Time, that you made with Tom Petty, what a great record this
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
And it came right at that at the end of Tom Petty's life, so it's so shocking. How was it to work with Petty? I mean,
joy. It was absolute joy, and he loved music. I knew Tom, but I didn't know him as well as maybe McGuinn. McGuinn and Tom wrote a song or two together, and Roger had done some touring with Tom and Bob Dylan. But I got to know him really well in the time we worked together, the 6 weeks. Fantastic man, loved music, all kinds of music. And even today, I'll listen to the Heartbreak, Tom Petty XM radio show, and you go, my gosh, the Heartbreakers would tackle anything they liked. A Bo Diddley song, Jimmy Reed. They do. If they liked the song, they'd record it. I love that. That sort of free way of doing things. Of just a sort. But he was a joy. Certainly a joy to work with.
And so obviously influenced by you. I mean, the first time I ever heard American Girl, I said, "Is this the Byrds?"
Back then, Roger actually thought at one point back in the 70s, was it? Yeah, late 70s. I think he did that song. He said, did we cut that? Have we done that song? And I think he did record it. I think he went out after. And I think I wasn't working with Roger then. I think his road manager said, no, that's Tom Petty's. Wow. So they went in and cut it too. But that's the beginning of a really wonderful relationship. And when Tom died, we were in Nashville, as I write in my book, and I was just heartbroken. I couldn't believe it. It was October 2017. And I could not believe it. I was going to cancel the next four shows. And out of the blue, Roger McGuinn calls me and he says, don't do it. Do not cancel those shows. Tom would not like it if you canceled shows. Go play in his honor. Go dedicate them to him, which I did. I went back and continued the shows. Yeah. It was a loss for, not just for me, for everybody, you know, everybody in the world.
Yeah. It was a
mm-hmm. It was such a, an unnecessary poor guy. He needed to have his hip replaced, and he wanted to do this tour, and he should have if I could have, should have, would have, but you know, anyway, we lost a good one, a really good guy. And he wanted to do more recordings with me, which I loved. And he told me, he says, I'm not done with you. I got some more ideas. And I said, great. You know, but it's okay.
That's so frustrating. Do you think you'll make another record anyway?
I'm not sure, not right. I don't know. I really don't know. Let's see how everything resolves for all of us. You know, let's see where it all goes. Yeah.
I hope you're staying well and healthy.
Oh, God, I feel great. I really do.
The only good thing to come out of this pandemic for me is this whole Zoom thing, because normally I would just do these interviews on the telephone, but you and I are sitting together as though we're sitting in the same room.
Exactly.
And I can see your guitars and your records on the wall, and you have a lot of guitars back there.
I have more than I need. Actually, some of my friends that are professional players, I have a dear John Jorgensen, a dear friend. I've been working with him since 30 years, Desert Rose Band. He has about 250 guitars, and there are a bunch of them in England stored and over here. Yeah, but he's a go get 'em player. He's such a great musician. I might have 7 or 8, more than I need. I only need one. My wife reminds me, you only need one guitar and one mandolin. I said, you're right.
Do you play bass occasionally as well?
Otherwise it's in the closet. I don't know. Playing bass by yourself. But
when you came to play bass for the Byrds, you hadn't been a bass player before.
No, never even held an electric bass. But I bluffed my way into that job, and I knew because I had heard them sing. I heard Gene and Roger and David sing. I said, they're very good. I mean, so when I get the call, I said, oh yeah, I can play the bass. So I walk in there going, oh, help me, Lord. I asked Roger, a couple months ago. I said, hey, you know, I got to ask you a question. I said, was I like the 27th guy you called for the bass job? And he says, no, you were the first guy. You were perfect. It worked. And I didn't really know them. They didn't know me. But we knew each other by reputation because we would all play at the Troubadour Hootenanny open mic thing. Yeah, anyway.
And they knew that you knew the harmony thing because you had had the bluegrass.
Yeah. Record. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. And I had a good resume.
Yeah. To what degree do you think that bluegrass harmony influenced the Byrds harmonies?
Well, interestingly enough, David Crosby had such an ear for harmony, and his influences were just like Brian Wilson, where they listened to the High Lows, the Four Freshmen, and that kind of four-part jazz singing. And it was a different take on regular harmony by way of 1-3-5, 1-3-4 church type harmony. But the bluegrass trio singing and quartet singing had a great influence on us. And that's really the way it went, as it did with everyone, Poco, the Eagles. But with David, we got a different thing in the mix. And his singing was so great. His harmony was so different and beautiful with what he did. And he's still a great singer. He's 79 years old. He still gets it. But the harmonies that David and Gene and Roger, and later David and Roger and I got were quite good. Quite good. We knew what we were doing.
Well, and when you started writing songs all of a sudden, which kind of happened, you know, kind of midway through your time with the Byrds, you know, who had been your songwriting influences? Had you, you mentioned literature briefly in your book. I mean, was there a lot of stuff that you'd been reading? Had you ever written anything before?
All I had ever written before, I would do liner notes. People would call me to do liner notes. I never had written a book before. But as far as songwriting, all I had written was an instrumental, a mandolin bluegrass instrumental, but it was fun. I was 18 years old. But writing, it just happened. You know, in the book, I do a session for Hugh Masekela, total jazz session, and it was so much fun. And once again, I'm really reaching for it because it was another level of music there. And it was for a lady from South Africa, Letta Mbulu, a Swahili lady. And it was so much fun. I came home and started writing songs. Go figure. I don't know. It just opened up a door in my brain. I'm using door a lot today, but it did. It opened up something in my brain. And I start writing songs and haven't stopped since. Well, I have stopped recently for a while, but temporary anyway.
Yeah. Well, your book, which is called Time Between, My Life as a Bird, a Burrito Brother and Beyond. You don't have a co-author. You wrote every word of your book.
Absolutely. When I had this manuscript sitting around, I said to my wife, we need to find an agent. I think otherwise I'm just going to give it to the kids and the later grandkids, which we have now. And all of a sudden I meet Scott Bomar from BMG Publishing, and he had heard I was writing a book and he was interested. Can I read some of it? And I sent him some of the manuscript, and he got right back to me. He says, I'd like to talk to you about publishing your book. And he sits me down and he said, I said, I'm not handing you a salacious rock and roll book about this guy, drugs, da da da. I'm writing about the music and what I did in my journey. And he said, that's the book I want. I don't want the other kind. I want what you want. And he said, I think we don't need a co-writer. You're writing. You're a very good writer. I said, wow, thank you. That was the best thing I could hear. I went back and I started rewriting things, and I pulled things out. I added things. My wife was wonderful. She said, she would say, why don't you embellish this session you did in 1969 with the Burrito Brothers and where you did it. And I would sort of go over it quickly. She had some great ideas. Scott Bomar had the great idea, Gary, of opening the book with our house fire in 2017. Here I am, and Tom dies in October in this matter of 2 months in December on my birthday. We have this huge fire in Ventura, where I live, and almost lost our home. We didn't. We lost our kitchen and something else. But it was pretty tough there for a minute. But I love Scott. He edited, good editor. He takes that part, opens the book, and then we go backwards. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that wasn't the only fire in your life.
A great affinity for fire. I don't know what that means. Being young, was 3 or 4 years old, 3 years old, I think it was, and when our house caught on fire in Rancho Santa Fe. And then in the Byrds, I lost the entire house. And David had been over for a while. Right? Fire started. Anyway, No, actually, that's true. He did come over. I think I wrote about that. But yeah, I think I'm done with fires. I hope.
I hope so.
I really do hope so. I'm done with those. Yeah.
So are there a lot of salacious details that you left out of your book? Will there be a salacious volume two?
Yeah. Well, I purposely did not go there. I didn't want to denigrate anybody I'd worked with, as I said earlier. What's the point? You know, yeah. I mean, they all had wonderful things about them, and some of them made some really bad decisions, and they aren't with us anymore. And that's about as far as you want to go. I don't think it's necessary for me to say, well, I found Graham Parsons passed out and I revived him once again. It wasn't necessary. You know, I loved Graham dearly, and I just got to the point where I couldn't help him. And I had to, I said, I can't work with you anymore. Hoping he would get it together, which he did for a while. Then
that was probably a help. And of course you helped him by introducing him to Emmylou Harris.
I did. And I had to, sitting in outside of, where were we? We're in South Carolina or something. And I had run into him, and he had found out where we were playing, and he came in the Burritos. He came and sat in, sang a song with me. And I want to say something. The Burrito Brothers, as I kept saying it, we were so sort of lazy in our execution, but I built that band up, and I'm not patting myself on the back, but the Burritos were sounding great towards the end. I mean, it's a live band, and we had a really good group. But so Graham comes along, he sings with me, and I said, he says, I'm going to go back to LA. I want to find a girl singer. I went, I know just the person. But it took me about almost 2 hours to get him to call her. Right. And I said, just call Emmylou Harris. Emmylou Harris. I said, call her up. He finally calls her and starts telling her. And Graham was a very charming man. I mean, he already won her over within 20 minutes. And typical. He goes, well, can you pick me up at the train station? I'm down here in Maryland or someplace, wherever we were. And she says, no, I'm not going to pick you up. I don't even know you. But I said, go to D.C. She was playing in Washington, D.C. in Georgetown. I said, just go there. Meet her. Talk to her. And he loved her, and he took her to L.A. and a matter of weeks later, and off they went, you know. And he got her going, but he also gave her some wonderful instruction in country music. Because when I heard Emmy, she was doing more folk music when I heard her, you know. But she was sort of aware of it all. But Graham really got her into some good stuff.
And she became such a huge country star.
Huge, huge, still revered all over, yeah.
And so she owes that to you. I hope she said
that. I wouldn't say. I don't know. I mean, I think Emmy was a major talent, always has been. And she's a good friend. And, you know, I'm happy for her. I'm really happy for her.
And we should just mention the Desert Rose Band, which was such a great.
Yeah.
You guys did some great records. And
they had a lot of success on the charts. And it was amazing. And it was the longest I'd ever been in a band. I was in that band 8 years. And from 1985 until almost 1995, almost 10 years, really. But good band, great on stage. And we were in the 90th percentile for live performances. I mean, my John Jorgensen on guitar, J.D. Manus on steel, who I'd been working with since Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And the whole band was just so good. Herb Peterson, vocals. And we had songs, I must say. I was into my element there. And we had some incredible success. Yeah.
I love
the best thing was, and not to dwell on the Desert Rose Band, but the country fans accepted us for our music. They didn't connect the dots. Most of them didn't connect the dots of Birds, Burrito Brothers, Desert Rose. Most of them just heard us for what we were.
So you want to be a rock and roll star. I mean, you're a guy who is a rock and roll star, and yet you've probably been able your whole life to walk down the street without anybody stopping you and saying.
Correct. And I love my anonymity. Believe me, I didn't want that. As Tom said, Petty said that in an interview. He says, I don't think Chris ever liked show business. And I read that. I was absolutely. I did not care if I went to the gig in the limousine. Never did. Didn't. That wasn't. I was a musician. And Tom figured that out real quick. But yeah, I didn't want them. And he would go out on tours, Tom, and he couldn't leave his room half the time, his hotel room, yeah. And I guess Dylan would go out, when he'd go out on the road, he'd go out in disguise and walk around, look like a homeless man.
Yeah. Before we go, tell me about your hair. So when you were a bird...
I love that question. I'm going to offer anybody who buys my book, I will give you hairstyling tips on the cover.
you had a beetle haircut that was very straight, and then all of a sudden you didn't have that. You had curly hair.
Well, I was born with curly hair. And here I am at 19 in the Byrds, and all the guys had cool hair, and I'm going, well, you know. And I went to great play. I had to go to a lot of work to get my hair to look straight. And it was so funny here. Growing up in California, we have no humidity, and I'd have it perfectly straight. And I go back and we play a gig in Kansas in August. Out on stage, and I'm bling, and the hair would go up in curls. And finally, this guy that cut our hair, he says, you know, let's stop doing this. And he says, look at Dylan's hair. Your hair is just like that, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up, and I stopped doing that. But yeah, it's funny. It was so funny. I kept in the different pictures in the book, and the hair was always changing, and giant hair. I said, giant.
Well, Chris Hillman, what a joy it's been for me to meet you and talk to you. The book is called Time Between, My Life as a Byrd, Burrito Brother, and Beyond. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you, Gary, for having me on your show. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chris Hillman's new book is called Time Between, My Life as a Byrd, Burrito Brother, and Beyond. This is KSCO in Santa Cruz. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf.
I'm happy to welcome From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren back to the show. Lissa has brought many great books to my attention, and today she has a few that she wants to tell us about. And Lissa Warren, thank you so much. Welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. Good to be back with you.
What do you got for us today?
I have The Little Vegan Dessert Cookbook. It's subtitled Vintage Recipes Revised, and it's by Laura Crotty, published by Lincoln Square Books.
Oh, well, I'm happy to hear about this, you know, because I'm vegan. I mean, I do eat, sometimes I'll eat eggs or dairy, or sometimes chicken, turkey, pork, beef, veal, goose liver pate. But other than that,
you're totally vegan.
Yeah. But so are you vegan?
You know, I'm not. I'm trying to be vegetarian, not vegan. That would be a more accurate description of me. Baby steps, you know. But this book, it's adorable. It has a small trim size, and it's full of vintage illustrations. And it makes sense because the author collects vintage cookbooks. And the recipes in this book are all vegan versions of her favorite recipes from them. There are vegan versions of classics like Tall House Inn chocolate chip cookies, chocolate cake from the 1934 Hershey's cookbook, and my favorite, s'mores. Those are from the 1927 Girl Scout Handbook.
Wow. What are some of the recipes in it?
Well, if you're in holiday baking mode, there are vegan recipes for peanut butter cookies, blondies, and Linzer tarts. And with their little red raspberry centers, they are super festive looking, so perfect for the holidays.
And if you're feeling a little grinchy this year?
Well, maybe then you need some comfort food, Gary. There are vegan recipes for coffee cake and tea bread and other warm beverage companions for, you know, when it gets cold there in California.
Oh, yes, yeah,
for you means maybe, what, 70 degrees?
Yeah,
something like
yeah,
that. Yeah. There are also vegan versions of stuff your grandma may have made for you, like carrot cake and pineapple upside down cake, food that reminds you of family, food that feels like home.
Oh, that sounds great. The Little Vegan Dessert Cookbook. I want one. What else you got?
Well, there's a really cool book out called Physical Intelligence: Harness Your Body's Untapped Intelligence to Achieve More, Stress Less, and Live More Happily. It's by Patricia Payton and Claire Dale, and is published by Simon & Schuster.
Live More Happily. Is that grammatically correct?
It is, because it's been published in a book.
Okay. I didn't know there was more than one kind of intelligence.
Yes. Howard Gardner first introduced us to his theory of multiple intelligences in 1983. And then, thanks to the work of Daniel Goleman, many of us are familiar with the concept of emotional intelligence. But now Patricia and Claire focus on physical intelligence, and they show how harnessing it can help us in both our personal and our professional lives.
So what are some of the things that you learned from physical intelligence?
Well, did you know that we're 45% more likely to have an innovative idea when we're walking instead of when we're seated? And when we succeed, testosterone, dopamine, and adrenaline levels rise, and that creates a surge of elation. And then we want to repeat that feeling, so we double our efforts for the next time. And that, my friend, is the chemistry of the winning streak.
Wow. So does this physical intelligence play a role in relationships too?
Yeah, a bigger role than most of us think, actually. For example, in the first moments of meeting somebody, we subconsciously weigh whether or not we trust them. And we assess whether we trust their body as we look for stable eye contact and open body language, an authentic tone of voice, and of course, a responsive face.
Hmm. I remember when that body language book came out a few years ago, maybe 20 or 40 years ago now.
It makes a difference. It really does. And, you know, I also learned in this book that when we share stories that let people know a little bit about us, it shows that we understand others, and then oxytocin is released in ourselves and in others, which builds trust. Anyway, these are the kinds of things that are rooted in neuroscience and physiology that are peppered throughout this book. I found it fascinating. I really did.
Well, I love oxytocin.
It's the feel-good hormone.
So physical intelligence, what's the title? Physical intelligence?
Physical intelligence, how harness your body's untapped intelligence to achieve more, stress less, and live more happily, which we've established is grammatically correct.
And you have one more for us.
I do. It's called Doing the Right Thing, 12 Portraits in Moral Courage, and it's by Tom Cooper, PhD. It's published by Abramus Publishing.
And so you feel that this is a pretty timely book.
Yeah, very much so. Cooper is an ethics professor, and he served as an ethics expert for the United Nations. And this book looks at a dozen leaders who, when faced with challenging ethical decisions, made the right choice, even at risk to their careers, their lives, or the lives of others. So it's extra relevant as a new administration prepares to take office, but also because all of the ethical issues that COVID presents are really, really crucial. Cooper had an op-ed in USA Today about that very topic this past August, and you can Google that if you want to, but really he's good about showing in that op-ed that it's more than should we mandate masks and who gets the first vaccines, a lot of ethical decisions related to COVID and everything else, he proves.
Who are some of the people that he profiles in the book?
The book's really satisfying in that it includes some people you might hope would be in it, like John F. Kennedy, Harry Truman, Mandela, Gandhi. But it also has some surprises, like British politician and philanthropist William Wilberforce, who led the movement to abolish the slave trade. And then also Edward R. Murrow, whose television news reports helped to lead the censure of Senator Joseph McCarthy.
No, I love Murrow. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, he's amazing. It was amazing. Yeah.
In fact, this thing that we're doing right now is kind of like, his show where he would visit people in their home, just like.
Yeah, it kind of is in a way. Yeah, yeah. You're so Murrow.
Yes, I am. I'm smoking right now. Here.
There you are. Ah, yes, I can hear the puffing from here.
Yeah, I got a cigarette out there for those of you who are listening on the radio, like everybody. So what about women? Are there any women in the book?
I am so glad you asked. There are several. My favorites were Rachel Carson, who chose to testify before Congress about the danger of pesticides.
Silent Spring.
She knew that it could prematurely end her award-winning work, but she did it anyway because she thought it needed to be out there. And then the other woman in the book that I really, really loved hearing about was two-time Nobel Prize recipient Marie Curie. She agonized over whether she should stay in Paris and continue her important scientific research into X-rays or flee to Warsaw after she received death threats. Because, you know, working with radium isn't scary enough. You have to be receiving death threats, too. By the way, did you know that when she died, her body was so radioactive that they had to line her coffin with nearly an inch of lead?
Really?
Well,
let's remember not to visit her grave. Where is she buried? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't think that was in the book, but boy. Hot stuff.
All right, just run down the titles of your three books again for us.
You bet. We've got The Little Vegan Dessert Cookbook, Physical Intelligence, and Doing the Right Thing.
Lisa Warren, it's always so nice to talk to you. Come back and see us again soon.
I will. Take care. Happy holidays.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.